This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn.
When we see them on TV or in the movies, they are the ultimate bad guys. People you never want to meet in a dark alley or get a lift from when hitchhiking. So what would make someone want to have anything to do with them, to write to them and get to know them? Well, that's what writer and researcher Amanda Howard has done. She's corresponded with more than 50 serial killers, infamous men like Charles Manson and Richard Ramirez, and Australian serial killers such as Ivan Milat, David Burney and John Glover. What has she learnt and why does she do it? She's our very special guest this morning. Amanda, good morning.
Good morning, Rod.
Most of us, you know, have a vague interest perhaps in serial killers, but only fictitious ones, really, or ones that we've seen on TV or in movies. Why did you take that interest much, much further?
Oh, sometimes I wonder myself. it actually started with John Glover, the Grand Killer. It was a case that was early in, well, it was probably late teens that I found the interest. I was actually planning on being a singer and a dancer. And that case came along and we had a profiler try and tell us what this serial killer was going to be like, and said it was going to be this young man who was horrifying to his grandmother and had no job and, you know, was probably on the dole and was beating up people. And then we find out it's a 50-year-old man who was married with two daughters and held down a job. It actually hooked me instantly that these killers are actually not these horrifying bad men that we expect, but people's fathers, brothers, sisters, mothers. It's actually quite surprising.
So of all the ones that you have learnt about, is that something that maybe ties them together, that links them together, that these are people who are normal? They don't live on their own. They generally live in a community, in society. They are married. They've got children. Is that right? Because one of the things we often hear about serial killers is that they do live on their own because they spend a lot of time planning and they need to be able to retreat to where no one knows where they are.
No, as you said, they're actually our normal people. We have to remember that if they were scary and if they were antisocial, how would they get their victims often into their cars or get them to chat and wander off from a nightclub? They're actually very good conversationalists and very good at what they do. Now, normally they're often arrogant and they don't often have a massive circle of friends, but they do fall in love and they do have families. They aren't completely shut off from the rest of the world, except in those times when their need or desire to bring out that violence comes to a head, and that's when they're very much a different person. But that's often compartmentalised and put away so they can function in normal society. That's how they don't get caught for so long.
So being interested in that case, which I remember quite well, gripped Sydney and certainly the rest of Australia, where John Glover murdered, what was it, five or six women, two in 2 days on one occasion. Mm-hmm. There was a real fear in the community at that mm-hmm. time. That's all very well, and taking an interest in it. Did you contact him then?
Well, I actually, at school, I had a teacher tell me that I should go to the source, and if I'm ever doing any research in later life, that I should always make sure that I question any source I get and actually find out as close to the original source as possible. Don't think she thought about serial killers when she said that, but I was doing criminology at uni the following year, and I was reading a textbook on Ivan Milat, like a case study in my criminology textbook. And what it said was actually factually wrong, that I knew, living so close to the killer myself, I can actually see his house from where I'm sitting right now. And so I decided to actually reach out to a lot of these killers to question what's in the textbooks, what's on TV, what's in the newspapers, to actually get that factual information as best as you can from a psychopathic serial killer.
So there's so many questions really I need to ask. So you began with Australian killers?
No, I started with US killers. Let's face it, they have 400,000% more than the rest of the world. They have 1,300 incarcerated serial killers right now. We have 12, I think.
And so, what is your working definition of a serial killer?
It's those that kill three or more. Okay. Now, if we go to the proper terms where they say that they have to be in different locations, well, that would cut out a lot of serial killers like John Wayne Gacy, the killer clown, who actually killed and retained the bodies under his house. So I don't go into that specific classification, but I do. All right. They need to kill three or more.
So where did you start? Who did you start with?
Arthur Shawcross was one of my first. He's actually one of the people used by author Thomas Harris to create the character of Hannibal Lecter. So he was a cannibal and was able to regulate his heart rate even when he was killing.
And so, what did you, when you say Dear Arthur, what follows after that?
I usually write a whole page of questions. I start off, you know, talking about siblings, favourite subjects at school, things you like to eat, with a cannibal that actually came back as a recipe with me in the ingredients.
With you as one of the ingredients?
Absolutely. So
was he being funny or not?
Words. Yes, it's all a cat and mouse game. So they often have these games where they try and shock and get the upper hand. But, I mean, I've been doing this for 25 years now, so they can't shock me anymore. But at the time it was, oh, okay, where do you go from here? But I quickly shut him down.
And do you write back to them?
Yes, I currently am writing to about 45 serial killers at this present time. So my handbag has about 15 letters waiting for
return mail. All right. And with the information that you get, what good comes of that information? Because I think people would be listening to this and thinking, you know, isn't there something better that you can do if this information is not being used to perhaps improve society or make it safer?
I've written 25 books on the subject, so I've released what comes in out into the world, that there is a bit more of an understanding of what these serial killers are. I mean, when I first started, we all talked about serial killers being white males between a certain younger age group, and now we know that that is totally wrong. They don't kill just within their racial confines. They cross the victimology rates. You know, it could be males this week, a female next week. That can actually happen. Right. There was a Russian serial killer who killed children, young teen boys and elderly females. So it's actually quite surprising that they do that.
Although it is it mostly white males, though?
No, I think it's a mix.
Who are the killers rather than the victims?
No. It's indicative of the society's makeup. So, that percentage of black serial killers is equal to what the society percentage is.
All right. However, it's mostly men, not women.
Yes, or definitely.
Why is that?
Because we prefer to hold grudges. Sorry. It's more about that women that are serial killers often do it over a greater length of time. They're more the passive sort of killer with poison and things like that.
Yes.
Whereas men have often explosive rage outcomes that end up with violence, and often it's linked to abuse in childhood, but not always. It's linked to a lack of power in relationships and things like that.
Okay. Now, these are people in prison that you're corresponding with for the most part. I doubt that any of them would be out, would they?
Not the ones I've spoken to, but there is serial killers that have been released. In some countries, a life sentence is 15 years, and so they do get out quite quickly.
Okay. So you're corresponding with them in prison, and therefore they have time, nothing but time, to do this. Do some of them, though, get sick of people writing to them, questioning them as you do, or just writing to them as a fan, strange as that may seem?
Yeah, well, there is a lot of fans out there. I have a lot of things that serial killers have sent me saying, oh, my God, you wouldn't believe what this person sent me, or this girl sent me a photo of her in her underwear. Doesn't she realise that that's a bit pathetic and things like that? So they really don't like their fans. their pen pals, whereas I'm
How do you get past that?
Well, I research and I tell them that I'm not there to play games. I'm not there to admire them. I'm there to find out who they are and how they ended up where they are today. Because, I mean, people don't, you know, as children, they don't say that they're going to be a serial killer. This happens. And so I'm very interested in how you can go from, like Edward Spreitzer, a killer in Chicago. He said, I wanted to be a aged care nurse. And he ended up raping and killing 17 women. So how does one go from that to that? So
and what have you found? Like, what kind of insight is there within these people that they're able to look at that moment when they went from someone who was not a killer to someone who was, and then someone who was perhaps someone who killed only one person and therefore someone who killed two, three or more?
Sometimes it's about that perfect storm. It's about that moment when most of us, you know, might, like, we don't all have a fantasy about violence, but a lot of people do have a fantasy about violence and don't act on it. But there's that perfect storm where they decide, do they cross over that threshold or do they step back? A serial killer often loses that ability to say, no, I shouldn't do that. They decide, I want that, I'm taking it. And it's that sort of moral compass that they don't seem to have that the rest of us do. So whereas we might think about it, they do.
Now, one of our texters says there are cowards who usually pick off sex workers, drifters and the elderly. Is that something that you find to be the case?
No, the greatest number of victims is actually males.
So they're killing other men?
They're killing other men.
Why?
So, and that's across society, is that young men are actually the number one victim of most crimes, which is quite surprising because we think it's going to be the defenceless. We think it's going to be those lower risk victims. It's because that's who they choose to kill. I mean, John Wayne Gacy killed 33 young boys and men. It's often to do with their own sexual orientation. They might kill, like John Wayne Gacy did, because he wanted to hide the fact that he was gay and didn't know how to take on that sexuality as a normal person would. So he killed as almost a self-hatred.
Seems a very extreme way of dealing with that problem. Mm-hmm. Some of what they tell you is truly horrific.
Mm-hmm.
How can you bring yourself to read it?
It's what I've done for so long. I mean, I'm currently doing my master's in criminology, so I've been trained and learned how to do this. Part of my role when I worked for the police service many years ago now was to actually read all these high profile cases and to actually write a brief on them. So it's something I've done for a very long time. So you actually learn to have that balance in life. I have a very supportive family who knows that sometimes it does get dark, and they know to take me away from that so it doesn't engulf me. I need to be able to hope that I'm doing some good by sharing this info out there, but also know that I need to keep myself good and keep my heart pure and be able to say today, that's enough.
Have you ever met any of them?
Yes, several of them. So people are actually quite surprised by how often small and pathetic they are in real life. They aren't these Hannibal Lecter, you know, cue the dramatic music. It's more sitting in a room with a whole bunch of people and spotting people that you know from across the room saying, I know that killer, I know that killer. So they're often polite and a bit more fearful in person, but they aren't the monsters that everyone hopes and wants them to be.
Are they charming? We often hear about serial killers being charming.
Oh, absolutely. As I said, that's how they get them into cars. That's how they get that victim to follow them to wherever they want to go, is because they can throw on the charm, and that's how they often get away with what they do.
What about within a prison? Are they at the top of the hierarchy in a prison?
No, absolutely not. I mean, in some prisons that they would be, but David Burney was bashed often. He was in Perth. He was a serial killer with his common law wife, and when he went to prison, he got bashed all the time. Up until his very last days, he was being beaten frequently until he was in segregation. But even still, they would get to him.
You had a rather a strong connection with him, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I spoke to him for about 10 years, and we would have conversations on the phone. I have several killers that ring me. And he actually rung me the night that he took his life, because the prisons were severing our contact because there was some information that I obtained from him that the prisons didn't want me to know.
Are you able to tell us what that is?
It went to Crime Stoppers, so it was regarding an unsolved serial killer case that was going on at the time that they've now arrested a man for.
Oh, okay, so I think we may know what that one is.
Yes.
Amanda Howard is our guest, crime author, serial killer whisperer, some would say. What do you do with the information you collect? What do you want to know from them?
I want to know the whys. I want to know what makes a child become a serial killer. Because, you know, a lot of people talk about that it's going to be due to abuse or poor family upbringings, but there is just as many serial killers from good families than there is from bad. So I often say it's like when we have a baby and you buy the baby books and the baby doesn't do what the baby book says and we get frustrated. Well, that's the same with serial killers. We were given this profile. We were given these programs to say this is what a serial killer is, this is what a serial killer does. But we've learnt from there that they are just as diverse as the rest of society, and that it's about now working out what sort of serial killers are. You know, under that umbrella term of serial killers, we have our sex killers, we have our torturers, we have our cannibals, we have our poisoners, and they all do it for different reasons and have all different motives for why they do it. So I'm trying to slowly work my way through as many serial killers as I can to find out, is there these common threads, is there these common themes that actually destroys that original profile, and how we can make better profiles that may be a bit more fragmented because serial killers are as society is.
Okay, so if you do come up with these links, is that going to help police or others stop people before they become a serial killer? One of the things, you know, watching the TV series Mindhunter, which I'm sure you've watched,
mm-hmm.
about development of how the FBI were tracking serial mm-hmm. killers or dealing with them, is maybe many potential serial killers are arrested after just one murder. That it's quite possible that they would have gone on with it, but in fact they are arrested after only one. How do we know that someone had the potential to become a serial killer? I mean, you could talk to a whole lot of killers that had that potential and try and work out what was going on in their mind as well.
Absolutely, and that's what I am doing. I don't just talk to serial killers. I talk to, I have a guy who bombed at police headquarters on my list of killers I speak to. But yeah, in this country, we're very good at actually catching them before they become serial killers, whereas the States isn't so much because they cross state lines and people just don't talk to each other and things like that. But it is about working out what the propensity is for further crimes if they weren't caught. And there is a lot of that happens, and there's a lot of my research is about that. Because we do talk about escalating crimes. Some of them start with arson, some of them start with rape, some of them start with torturing animals. And so it's not just about the actual final acts of being a serial killer and killing three or more people, but it's about what led to that. And some have nothing until they have a first explosive kill, like BTK killer in Kansas. He, which is in Mindhunter, not that they're talking about the killer yet, but he's that little...
He's the other story the first, that's...
So he actually starts with annihilating a whole family. So that's his first kill. So, you know, that is very rare, but why was he able to do that, and why was he able to elude capture for 25 years? So there's so many different elements of this genre, for want of a better word, that we need to find out how and why these people are created, or if they're born. I mean, that's a whole other discussion for a different day, but it's about how we can decide.
Let's assume that you do that. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting thing. You decide who to watch, who might be a potential serial killer. But until they commit a crime, there's nothing you can do about them. And you can't, even if it's a minor crime, for example, where you might put them away for a year or two, they just come out again. You can't put somebody in jail for their whole life for their protection and protection of society. It's quite possible they're going to kill two or three people before they get sent to jail.
Absolutely. But at the same time, we allow people out on bail that have killed or have done serious harm to people. I mean, that there's some of the system that doesn't work. But
most most people who kill, 80% of them or so, it'll be somebody they know. It will be in maybe a crime of passion or a crime in order to get money or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's what happens. I mean, serial killers are such a tiny part. In fact, the murder rate really has halved over the last 50 years or so. Mm-hmm. They're just nowhere near as many as there used to be. I mean, maybe we're doing the right thing anyway.
I think we are. This is certainly not the country for someone who's an expert in this field, unfortunately. But
or fortunately.
Well, it is, but not for business kind of thing. But that's a whole different argument. But we are good at detecting cases, and our clearance rate is so much better than the rest of the world. So we do the right thing. But as you say, we can't put someone in jail just in case they might. And that's the problem. But we get them when they do that first or second killing, usually. So our clearance rates are good. But the US, I mean, there's currently several hundred serial killers that are killing across the United States that they know about, but there's not much that they can do or are doing to actually solve these cases.
What, they don't have the evidence, or they don't have the time, the manpower?
Well, they don't like to link it. The US is very good at saying that they don't have serial killers, which is quite surprising considering the statistics of how many they actually do. But, I mean, there's several truckers that are currently killing right across the country because they pick up a victim here and dump them there, and people aren't linking all of that up. I mean, just across the border into Mexico, there's a serial killer there who has killed hundreds of sex workers. But
are we sure it's the same person doing it, or it could be a whole lot of others? I know there have been problems in Canada as well.
Yeah, well, there's a guy in Canada currently who was putting his victims into pot plants. I mean, there's a lot of killers that often go undetected, and it's often because of who the victims are, when it's sex workers or like the Canadian case where it's gay men, they don't want to investigate, whereas in this country that doesn't matter. We will still investigate.
Do they enjoy killing? Is that what you found?
A lot of them do. A lot of them love to actually explain what they did and how they did it and how they felt. That's the tough part to read. There is killers that do feel remorse, whether it's remorse they got caught or remorse that they did what they did. That's a bit grey. But, there is killers like David Burney who says, right, you caught me, here I am, I'm pleading guilty, we don't need trials, the family don't need that, I've already destroyed their lives, let's, close this case quickly. I mean, of course, you don't know if they did that because they were able to pinpoint four of his victims or if he was glad it was done. He was more of a spree killer than a serial killer, though, because his murders happened over a six-week period. Whereas most killers, most serial killers kill for many years. So, but they are human, and they do feel that they have caused harm.
So, do most operate on their own? Because you talk about the Burneys, Fred and Rosemary West were an appalling couple.
That's one of my obsessions. That case, I know so much about that case. It's just such an interesting feature of how these two people can come together and create such horrifying, torturous killings. It's just so fascinating to understand it. How does a couple get to that point?
Well, you've done this study. You tell me how. Because the Wests were terrible, and maybe people have seen that TV series Appropriate Adult, which is...
Oh, that's one of the best true crime films I've ever seen.
Remarkable, with an incredible performance by Dominic West, no relation, as Fred West. That what they did was so horrific. I don't know how you can bear to look into it. How does someone convince somebody else that this is a good idea? Because I'm guessing most of these people operate on their own.
Well, most do, but there is a few that don't, and I talked to a couple that do that. Edward Spreitzer was a group of five young men who killed 17 females over Chicago. It's more about a power thing. So often the weaker person might express a desire for graphic and violent fantasies, and the more powerful person might jump on that and use that to their own advantage. That it then escalates and escalates. With the Fred and Rose West case, it began as sexual abuse of their own children, and it went on from there. Now, both of them were victims of sexual abuse at the hands of both their parents as young children, so they actually had that warped sense of owning their children rather than, you know, helping them grow up to be responsible adults themselves. But it's then about often a bit of tit for tat. Well, if I rape this person, well, the next person you have to rape and stab, and it goes on and escalates into this horrifying frenzy of violence until they kill. I mean, Fred and Rose West killed for almost 25 years.
It's extraordinary. Mark is with us. Good morning, Mark.
Hi, Rod, and your guest. I was asking, you said they're charming, a lot of them, but did any of them that you met make you feel really uneasy or like...
As Mark says, some of them were charming. What about the ones that when you met them, you thought, oh, I don't like this at all?
I never forget who these killers are. I never fall for their charm. I never allow them to get the upper hand. I make myself be uneasy around them because I don't want to feel comfortable, because if I feel comfortable, then that's when things can get dangerous and they can get inside my head.
Are you ever,
which is what they continuously try to do.
Yeah, well, that's what they warn Clarice. Don't let them get inside your head.
That's true.
Are you ever alone with them?
No, never, never. They are in prison for a reason, and that's why there's a lot of guards and a lot of alarms and security and everything around you. It's not that I would think that they would attack me across the table, but it's more about that these are violent killers and you don't give them that opportunity.
Who were the ones who made you uncomfortable?
David Burney did the first time I met him, even though I'd been speaking to him for many, many years. It's always that moment. It's always that you look at them and say, you decided that you were going to end the lives of these young girls, you know, and I do get a hatred of them. I think, you know, like I lost my own husband, and it's a grief that I have to carry forever. And to know what they've done to these families, it's just horrifying. And so I keep that passion, that, you know, how dare you, in my head at all times with everything I do with them.
Okay. Owen, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Rod and Amanda. I have 2 points to make. The first point I wanted to make was, I really do echo what you and Amanda had been saying about how serial killers can be ordinary people like us. One of the most fascinating, he's certainly the most prolific, but I remember reading Anne Rule's book about Ted Bundy, the serial killer in the United States, and how he not only, he actually worked in the office of the campaign to elect a Republican lieutenant governor in Oregon. And he also, which is horrible considering what he did to his victims, he also worked apparently in a rape counseling center.
Oh,
and it's just, and then you look at Dennis Rader, BTK killer, who was a church elder. So, it's just amazing what sort of normal normal.
Okay.
And my second point I want, sorry.
Yeah, go on.
Second point I wanted to know, because one of the ones that really scared me, which I read about in the Sydney Morning Herald about 10 years ago, was a case called the Natchadi Jesus killer in Mexico, who was a female serial killer, and she went around killing women over 60. And remarkably, they all had the same painting in the house, so they thought there might have been a link to that.
How strange. All right, I'll get Amanda to comment on those two things. Thanks very much, Owen. What about that case in Mexico that Owen's talking about?
Yeah, well, there's been a few female killers that have killed female victims. I think the case he's talking about is the old granny that was cooking victims. I couldn't quite hear the whole conversation. But there has been links to things like photos and portraits in houses. Now, there is a case in England too of the crying boy case where people were being killed because they had a portrait of this crying boy. Now, it was something that was sold to thousands and thousands of people. And that's the same in Mexico, that it's a knockoff painting, and it's more often than not that three houses in the street had the same portrait. Oh. It was just fortuitous that some of the victims had this painting. Now, so,
can I ask, though, also about what Owen was talking about, is how when, you know, this goes on for a long period of time, or they've killed many, many people, how do they maintain a normal life? Working in their church, or working as Ted Bundy did, or why is it? How are they able to do that, to suppress that violent side of their personality and appear normal?
I mean, it's an internal struggle that they have, and people like Ted Bundy who killed, we think, up to 60, 70, 80 people, and Andrei Chikatilo in Russia who killed 52, towards the end, when they escalate so far, they actually start to lose their grip on reality, that their compulsion takes over, and when they've got away with it for so long, they begin to take risks. They begin to let that feed their whole personality rather than keeping it compartmentalised. And so they do actually often have mental breakdowns, and that's when they get caught. BTK was only caught because there was a press release saying that they're going to close the case as unsolved. And so he instantly contacted the police again and said, no, I'm still around, I'm still alive. And that's how they caught him, because they said, well, we want proof it's you. And he goes, well, if I send you a disc, will that work? And they said, yeah, go for that. And he said, well, can you track it? And they said, no, which they could, and they knew they could. So he borrowed a floppy disk from his local church, and they were instantly able to go to the church and say, who did you lend this floppy disk to? And they said, oh, that was Dennis Rader. Instantly caught.
Unbelievable.
After 25 years, as one of the most prolific serial killers.
Otherwise, it would still be a mystery. Michael, good morning. Michael.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Rod.
Yes. Yeah, what would you like to discuss?
I'd like to know your guest's opinion on Reginald Christie.
Yes.
Yep.
So I think you probably want to know, did Reg Christie kill the other family? Now, Reg Christie went to the gallows because he was found guilty of killing his wife and several other victims, but also in his house that he shared with another tenant was Timothy Evans, his wife and daughter. Now, Timothy Evans' wife and daughter were murdered, and they blamed Timothy Evans for that killing, and he actually went to the gallows himself. And it wasn't until years later when Reg Christie moved out of the home and another family moved in that they found his wife and three other victims in various places around the property. And so it was actually about 30 years later that the Queen gave a posthumous pardon to Timothy Evans, saying that John Christie killed his wife and daughter.
Now, all right, very sad story. People may have seen the movie 10 Rillington Place.
Yes.
About that. I want to ask about Charles Manson. Are you corresponding with Manson?
Yes. he's...
Now, he must have people, he would have had people when he was alive, writing to him all the time for all sorts of reasons. What did you ask him?
Charles Manson gets the most fan mail, quote-unquote, than anyone in the entire world, which is quite terrifying when you think about that. So my stuff got lost in a lot of other things, but I did correspond with him briefly, and he is a babbler even in writing. I mean, I have a couple of phone calls from him too, but his letters are just as scattered as any interview you see with him. It's always about, you know, government control, what we can do as the free people and all of this sort of stuff. So the person that you see, he kept up that persona for his entire incarceration.
So when you say he kept up that persona, how do we know that was not his actual persona?
Because it would be exhausting. I mean, here is a very little man who tried to make himself be this massive personality, and it worked. I mean, he must have been good at it, because he was able to get so many followers do what he wanted. But there must have been a downtime. No one can go at that frenzied state for 24/7. There is no possible way.
Why would Manson be considered a serial killer?
He's not. He's not. So he did kill. There is people that he killed, but he did not kill anyone in the Tate or LaBianca killings. So he actually had people do it for him, which is why he went to prison. But he did kill Shorty Shea, and there's rumours he killed someone else as well.
Okay. All right. Vicky in Brisbane. Good morning, Vicky.
Oh, hi, Rod. How are you?
Very well, thanks. What would you like to talk about?
I watch a lot of these true crime things on Foxtel, murdering people and
well, they've
to get
got
away
Serial
murder.
Killer Sunday. They have
yes,
special
really.
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I watch that as well. It's hi, Amanda. I'm fascinated with what you do. That's just amazing. I think I could probably get addicted to what you're doing myself. However. There's a difference between a serial killer and a mass murderer.
Yes,
I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
And I have like watching all these shows. I've realised that a lot of these serial killers are your average Joe Blow. They've got wives and families, and you know they can't go out at night, go and kill somebody, and then come home and just have a meal and pretend like nothing's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And How are they able to just do that? Like, go out, kill somebody, come home, and just be, let's watch something on the TV or have a meal or whatever.
All right, compartmentalise their lives. How do they do it, Amanda?
Well, it's something that they actually learn, because we're all told about the right behaviours to have in life, and we often all have these explosive moments of anger and everything, and we move on from it. We get to that next day and, you know, you've had a fight with your husband the night before, you got all cranky, but the next day everything's okay. That's what they do with their victims. They often take trophies, so they have something to relive it, to keep them sated with what they did. But it's about being able to put that into a box and come back to it later. I mean, we all go to work and we put on the nice face and the nice voice and the smile and everything. Then we get home and we bitch and moan about what happened that day at work. They do that with killings.
Okay, now, we've got plenty of calls we've got to get to in the last 10 minutes, but we do have some text messages as well. Have you, Amanda, ever spoken to the Snowtown murderers?
I have tried. I haven't been successful. However, I did a TV segment about the case early last year, and I actually switched two names around. I didn't say James Vlasakis and Mark Hayden. I said Mark Vlasakis, and on live TV that these things happen. Yeah. Well, John Bunting came at me via a secondary person on Facebook saying, you know, how dare you talk about our case when you can't even get our names right? So my response back to him was, you know, live TV, these things happen. So they know who I am,
okay.
But I haven't actually tried to contact them again. I have spoken to James Vlasakis, though, who is in protective custody.
All right. Riley says, what's the percentage of serial killers who are absolutely adamant that they are innocent and will never confess? Do most of them actually boast about what they've done?
No, most of them claim to be innocent. You know, I have John Robinson I speak to in Kansas, and he spends the whole time talking about how he's innocent and he didn't do these crimes. The fact that the victims are found in barrels on his property makes his argument a bit null and void. But a lot of them, I mean, Ivan Milat does. I reckon Ivan Milat could actually do a lie detector test and get through it because he's so convinced of his innocence. I mean, a lot of them do that, and I have to wade through that.
Mark says, would it be reasonable to say a serial killer is a person of high intelligence?
Yeah, they're smarter than we think. I try and seek out the more intelligent ones that I know are more intelligent. So far, I haven't had a battle of wits with many of them, but they're quite personable. They aren't, I mean, I have some that are still learning to read and write. Edward Spreitzer in Chicago, for example, has learned to read and write in prison. So his writing is very disjointed and like a child, and his intelligence is probably a 15-year-old. But he tries, but most of them are of average to above intelligence.
And Cheryl says, have you interviewed Beckett and Camilleri, two people who killed two girls from Bega?
No, it's a case that I'm interested in, but no, I haven't tried to get to them, no.
Okay, all right. Adrian, good morning.
Yes, hello. Does your guest view serial killers as just freak phenomenon that pop up or is indicative of a murderousness that can be anywhere in human societies? Because some leaders are serial killer like Duterte in the Philippines, and an Australian journalist questioned Duterte at a press conference, and he very subtly turned on the Australian journalist, and the look on the man's face was just to think that he realised that he may not get out of there alive if he asked another question. And I just thought Duterte and his minions have unleashed murderousness, and all these people aren't what we'd call serial killers individually, but it's just that kind of murderousness that is, you know, and I just thought Duterte is like a serial killer but with power. He doesn't get called a serial killer because he's a leader.
All right, that's an interesting thought.
Yep, there's a lot of psychopaths in a lot of different areas of power, and it is because they're psychopaths. So they do what they want to for their own personal gain. So absolutely, absolutely. There's a lot that may not kill, but they have all of the other traits.
Sasha is in Canberra. Good morning, Sasha.
Good morning, Rod and guests. Thank you for having this topic this morning. It was music to my ears in my insomnia this morning that I developed a fascination with serial killers. And my wife finds it quite morbid that I spend most of the night listening to podcasts of serial killers. Yeah.
There are a lot of them, that's for sure.
Yeah, and that was it. It was just opened up this whole world. And I guess the fascination for me is the psychology and what's behind the minds that are capable of doing these things that most of us just are shocked by. But I guess in my own fascination, I've developed a bit of conditioning to it as they must do with what they do. But to me, there are some threads in what people do, in why people do it. But I, the more I learn about it, the more I realise it's harder to really know why or to detect who would be a serial killer. It's more a thing that they catch down the track. There seemed to be a lot in America in the 70s, and a lot of males as perpetrators. Mm-hmm. But I think, like as Rod touched on earlier, that we're perhaps policing and CCTV that we're able to capture serial killers or potential serial killers earlier in the piece before they go on. The one that I really am fascinated with the most is Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yes.
Yep.
Milwaukee cannibal. What I found, we looked at a lot of the serial killers. Yeah, there was that thread of abuse. I think if you look at it's
Manson, even though he's not a serial killer.
No, but that behaviour and that psychopathy is Henry Lee Lucas in America also. Yep. Quite a few were abused. So you think, there's an indicator there, but then Jeffrey Dahmer didn't. He had quite a good family that he grew up in. His mother might have been a little bit unstable mentally,
yep,
but nothing strong. There was no abuse. And yep, somehow through his life, he developed this fascination with dead animals and carcasses and things, and that somehow got fused into his sexuality. and he's homosexual as well. So mm-hmm. that's the other thread that I saw with a lot of the male killers is the sexual side of the, right. the killing. There's that as well. But he, what fascinated me most about what he did was he consumed, and this is a bit grisly for, yes. for the listeners, but he consumed parts of his victims. And his mm-hmm. rationale for that was he wanted to feel close to them. He wanted them yeah. to be part of him. And, I just found it completely okay. fascinating.
Hey, so, Sasha, thank you very much. I'm sorry, we don't have a lot of time left. And, of course, he was later murdered in jail, was he not, Jeffrey Dahmer?
Yeah, he was.
Fascinating case. George, good morning.
Good morning, Rod and Amanda. A couple of people have picked up on something I wanted to ask, but I wanted to ask... Have any serial killers, and I know Amanda said a lot of them don't want to admit that they did the crimes, but the ones that might have done it, admit to it, do they kind of justify it by saying, well, there are, you know, mass murderers like your dictators like Duterte was just mentioned recently, and, you know, my crimes pale into comparison? And just quickly a second question, why is it that so many people in the public, as indicated by tonight, are so fascinated by serial killers, but they're not really interested in those big political mass murders who kill a lot more people, not as much anyway.
Okay, good point. Why is that?
Well, we're fascinated by serial killers because there is a randomness to the cases that we want to know that we're okay and that we feel safe because we're not a victim, that we're not serial yes. killers. You know, it's like how we all slow down at an ambulance, you know, on the side of the road with a car crash or something. We slow down because we often think, oh, now, had I left a bit earlier or had I not made a coffee or had I not stopped for petrol, I could have been that person. And with serial killer cases, we often think, you know, oh, well, I don't walk the streets at night. I'm not, you know, a young gay man. I mean, there's all of these things that we put in place to make ourselves feel safe. And I think that we see that as the absolute opposite
okay.
place than our lives.
Kevin's got one last question. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning, man. The three people who escaped from Alcatraz, the Angerman brothers and John Morris, Morris's yep. IQ was bordering pretty close to genius. Have you ever found any serial killers with an extremely high IQ?
Very interesting question.
Well, I was told that Ian Brady, who was the Moors killer in England, was highly intelligent. Well, I conversed with him for quite a while, and I'm smarter than him. I didn't find this stroke of genius that apparently was there. You know, I talked to him about a lot of the books that he was apparently supposed to have read, and he came across as an average person, but I didn't find this massive genius that was reported at the time. But no, there's none that sort of stick out as the most intelligent, but there is people like Harold Shipman, the doctor who killed 315 yes. of his victims, that could have been, but obviously he took his own life, so I never got to speak to him.
Appalling, terrible people. If people want to start reading some of the work that you've written based mm-hmm. on your research, where should they begin? What titles would you recommend?
Bound by Blood looks at an array of killers, not just serial killers. So there is people like, I can't think of his first name, but Fritzl, who kept his yeah. daughter under the house for 25 years. Fred and Rose West is in that book as well, so that's a good place to start. Murder on the Mind is another one of mine, or Killer Minds, which also looks at inside of serial killers' minds and okay. what they do. So.
And you can just write to any prisoner in Australia?
Yes
do you
and
need
no.
permission?
You can, but a lot of them, yeah, you get a letter back from the government saying
right.
you are writing to a killer, do you realise that kind of thing, and you have to sign waivers and things okay. like that. But others you can just write, and if they write back, they write back.
Amanda,
but,
we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately.
No, no worries,
but thank
Rod.
You so much for what has been a really fascinating discussion.
Thank you. I loved being on the show.